In this segment, we will continue our discussion of computerized provider order entry. In addition to the benefits noted at the end of the last segment, there have also been some well-known implementation failures with CPOE. The earliest one reported occurred at the University of Virginia in the early 1990s. The house staff, the interns and resident physicians, rebelled over the order entry system, which was implemented with very little of their input. The system was cumbersome and time-consuming to use. More recently, a similar significant implementation failure occurred at Cedars-Sinai Hospital in Los Angeles. Again, the users rebelled, feeling that the system significantly impeded their workflow. In retrospect, it was found that this homegrown, non-commercial system was really implemented without adequate planning. And in fact, 2 years later, CPOE still had not been re-implemented. Only recently has Cedars-Sinai begun to implement a new CPOE system. There have also been a couple negative studies that generated a lot of discussion and rebuttals. And so I will go through these studies and describe the rebuttals as well as the lessons learned from the whole process. The first negative study was authored by Russ Koppel and Associates, published in JAMA in 2005, and they performed an analysis of the Technicon system, which had been reported by users to introduce a number of errors into the clinical process. Now, the system that was studied was actually an old version of the system that was no longer available, though I would agree with Koppel that that's not necessarily a reason not to report the results. In any case, Koppel and Associates looked at the errors that were reported by users and categorized them. One group was information errors that came about by either fragmentation of information or the failure of the information to be integrated with that from other systems. So things like medication discontinuations, which were not carried out properly, the inability to carry out immediate orders, conflicting or duplicate medications was one set of errors. And then human-machine interface flaws, so the system functions did not correspond to the workflow, to how the work was organized or the usual behaviors of people who worked there. So information was scattered across multiple screens. There were also inflexible screens that made any kind of non-standard modifications very difficult. All in all, this was an old system, but it was one that the users were very dissatisfied with and appeared to be introducing errors into the delivery of care. David Bates, who is associated with a number of positive studies of CPOE, naturally had a lot to say, although in a very thoughtful and constructive way. He noted that the Koppel study did not count errors or adverse events, it just relied on reporting of them by the users. Their analysis also did not count any errors that may have been prevented by use of the system. David Bates also noted the older version of the software, in particular its problem of requiring multiple screens, and most CPOE implementations, like the one I showed in the last segment, put everything on the same screen, and that's pretty much a common accepted practice now. And even the vendor who provided that software has long since updated their system. And David Bates noted that CPOE is not something you just do when you're done with. It's a process that requires continuous improvement, as stated by his Ten Commandments that I talked about also in the last segment. Koppel replied that indeed the system was old, but represented what might be found in a commercial system as opposed to the kinds of homegrown systems that were mainly the object of David Bates' studies. He noted that the error types were stated by users based on their real experience, and he agreed in the value of CPOE, but called for it to be studied more thoroughly to identify its potential to do harm. I've since had the opportunity to be with both of these individuals and other advocates of CPOE in the same room, and everyone is in collegial agreement that CPOE has benefits as well as risks. The second study, perhaps a little more contentious, was the Hahn study, published in the journal Pediatrics in 2005. This was a retrospective study looking at 18 months before and 5 months after CPOE was implemented in the intensive care unit at Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh. The mortality rate before the implementation was 2.8%, and after the implementation was 6.57%. The authors speculated that the problems with CPOE were due to three main problems, one of which was the inability to write orders before the patient arrived at the ICU. The second was the time-consuming nature of order entry, and the third was a decision that went beyond CPOE, but a decision that was driven by CPOE to centralize medications in the hospital and not have a satellite pharmacy in the intensive care unit. Naturally, this set off a firestorm of activity, one of which was some centers doing the same sort of analysis at their own institution. So, for example, Del Baccaro at the University of Washington did a very similar analysis before and after CPOE on the children's wards at the University of Washington and found that there was no difference in the mortality rate. In fact, a number of CPOE experts commented on the differences between the studies and the implementations in a follow-up paper. Likewise, at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, a similar analysis was done and no increased mortality rates for CPOE was found. Now, it should be noted that any kind of before and after retrospective study is problematic because there can be confounding variables that have little or nothing to do with the outcome. So, for example, there could be other problems not really directly related to the CPOE. For example, it was noted by many that the wireless network for CPOE was inadequate. There was also centralization of the pharmacy, not directly related to CPOE, although part of the institutional changes that went on, but by moving the satellite pharmacy out of the intensive care unit, some medications were less readily available. Another issue was that there was no use of order sets, and that too may have been a confounder between these different studies. Dean Sittig then wrote a paper that really summarized all the lessons learned from the Hahn study and all of the follow-up to it. And there were lessons to be learned about implementing CPOE. First, although we've seen that some people do now undertake the Big Bang approach, but it was felt that probably the rollout of CPOE across the hospital in 6 days was too quick. Sittig also noted that order entry can be done before a patient arrives if it's implemented properly, and their planning process should have allowed this to occur, especially in the ICU, when orders oftentimes must be in place before the patient rolls through the door. There's this issue of centralizing the pharmacy. It's at best a confounding factor, and it's certainly nothing that is required for CPOE. There were also a variety of communication issues that came up, including nurses and others having to spend so much time doing CPOE that it kept them away from the bedside. There was this issue of requiring adequate network bandwidth. There was also the lack of standardized order sets that could have reduced the large amount of time it took to enter each order. And really, the ultimate conclusion from Siddig's paper is that there were well-known best practices in informatics known at that time that could have been helpful but were not followed, and in Siddig's mind, certainly in my mind, demonstrate the value of having informatics expertise in these large-scale health IT projects like CPOE. Joan Ash's more recent work has looked at some of the other unintended consequences of CPOE. Clearly, this is a complicated undertaking, and while it solves some problems, it introduces others. So she and her research team have looked at the consequences, both the anticipated and unanticipated, and within those, the desirable and undesirable ones, and have come up with a set of unintended consequences that were initially developed by a PhD student at OHSU, identified in 5 settings, and then verified by survey in 176 more. So CPOE can do the followings. It can create new work or more work. It can disrupt workflow. It can put demands on systems, not only computer systems, but healthcare systems. It can adversely affect communications. It can engender a variety of emotions when people are dissatisfied with it. It leads to new kinds of errors. It causes power shifts within organizations. And it creates an incredible dependence on technology, such that if the technology starts to underperform or perhaps becomes unavailable, it's quite disruptive to the healthcare process. Getting to this issue of time, we'll talk about time and EHRs in general in segment 4.6, but can we find ways to reduce time for order entry, since time is so essential for physicians? Well, there have been some approaches. For example, the WIS order system, developed at Vanderbilt University, guides clinicians in the order entry process and anticipates their next steps. It was designed by physicians to make order entry as efficient as possible. Other approaches have looked at things like natural language processing, where if you type in something like a drug dose, ranitidine 50 milligrams IV, Q8 hours, and then process the individual elements into fields, it has found that time is reduced in entering orders, taking a minute and a half off of an entire admitting order set. What about when clinicians override advice in CPOE or decision support? In David Bates' study of redundant lab tests, almost a third of all suggestions for cancellation were overridden by clinicians. However, when these overrides were given to experts, only 41% of them were deemed justified, and the experts believed the remaining 59% should not have been overridden. Another study looked at drug allergy overrides, and 80% of such alerts were overridden, usually with the clinician saying that he or she was aware and will monitor, or the patient not having the allergy. Still, this resulted in a 6% rate of adverse drug events in patients although all of the situations in which they occurred were deemed to be clinically justifiable. In a study at the VA looking at drug-drug interaction overrides, the pharmacists felt that only 20% of the reasons given for the overrides were deemed clinically useful, and otherwise that more information should have been presented. There have been some more recent studies and work done with regards to override of medication alerts. One study was quite comprehensive, looking at over 2,800 clinicians scattered across three states who generated over 233,000 medication alerts. Basically, 6.6% of all prescriptions generated an alert. And similar to most studies, clinicians rejected a large majority of these alerts. They accepted only 9.2% of the drug interaction alerts and 23% of the allergy alerts. Most of the drug interaction alerts were in the high severity category, meaning that they represented real and significant alerts, and these were slightly more likely to be accepted than those that were of lesser severity. Alerts were less likely to be accepted if the patient was already on some drug for which there was an identified interaction or allergy. Additional work at Partners Healthcare has looked at tiering of alerts so that only drugs that are prescribed and have a critical alert are work-stopping alerts. So that is an alert that must be either acted on or dismissed by a dialog box, whereas less critical alerts have the information just displayed on the screen and the physician doesn't need to actively do anything about it. This approach has led to a higher rate of acceptance of alerts, but still the acceptance is quite low, meaning that we probably need additional work to determine truly what are the most important alerts to give to physician and address this issue of alert fatigue. Various research studies have uncovered some other problems with CPOE. One study showed, for example, that about 1% of prescriptions have inconsistency between what is in the structured template and what is in the free text field. This is a growing concern when there is conflicting information between what's been chosen in the structured part of the prescription and then typed into the free text field. Another study, a qualitative study from field observations and interviews, showed that CPOE has substantial impact on clinical workflow, and the impact can be adverse on clinical activities when there's incomplete support for all the activities that go on around CPOE. Many have advocated that there needs to be better attention to workflow, so we might improve clinical practice using clinical decision support within CPOE. And one quality advocate has gone as far to call for putting higher priority on implementing barcoding before CPOE, that it will have likely better clinical outcome gains at lower cost. Finally, as our growth of content that goes into clinical decision support systems increases, we need better use of clinical knowledge management tools, as described by Sittig and colleagues recently. There have been growing calls for a focus on electronic prescribing, perhaps narrowly focused on that instead of the larger, broader CPOE. There has actually been the development of some software from the National E-Prescribing Patient Safety Initiative, or NEPSI, that allows ambulatory e-prescribing, but some have expressed concern that e-prescribing not be done in a standalone fashion, that it be integrated with electronic health record systems. Regardless, the uptake of e-prescribing has been substantial, especially between 2008 and 2009, where the number of prescriptions tripled from 68 to 191 million. The number of prescribers more than doubled from 74,000 to 156,000, representing about a quarter of all individuals who are eligible to prescribe. SureScripts, which owns the software that handles a lot of electronic prescribing, found that it could provide access to the benefits and prescription history of 65% of U.S. patients. And it also noted that 85% of all pharmacies were able to receive prescriptions electronically by the end of 2009. Well, wrapping up our discussion of clinical decision support over the last several segments, what are the grand challenges moving forward? Sittig and other leaders in the field published a paper in 2008, and much of what they listed as grand challenges are still that a few years down the road. So one category of challenges is to improve the effectiveness of CDS interventions, so everything from improving the human-computer interface, summarizing patient-level information, prioritizing and filtering recommendations to the user, combining recommendations for patients who have comorbidities, and using free text information to drive clinical decision support. They also focused on new CDS interventions, so prioritizing CDS content, development, and implementation moving forward, and mining large clinical databases to identify the areas where interventions are needed. Finally, better dissemination of existing CDS knowledge and interventions, so disseminating best practices in the design, development, and implementation of CDS, creating an architecture for sharing executable CDS modules and services, and creating internet-accessible CDS repositories, which some have suggested be something on the order of rules.gov, just like we have guidelines.gov, although one may see some who object to the notion of the government publishing rules. Nonetheless, these grand challenges provide a lot of work that still needs to be done in clinical decision support moving forward.